those extra 2 minutes that you wanted to go and spend on that America Online instant messenger. This was back in the AIM days. You could have just as well been studying. Later on, when I got my first tattoo, my mom was devastated, heartbroken. I failed as a mother. I raised a child that lowered himself down to the level of getting a tattoo. No matter that, by then I had completed 3 years of study at Pace University while holding a 3.7 GPA, had won 2 world dance titles, had never been arrested, not that my mother knew of at least, and was a loving, studious, violin-playing paragon of a son. But because of a tattoo, she had failed as a mother. And what did I choose for my first ink? A script on my left bicep that reads, "Family over everything." Such was the household where I grew up. Accountability was the byword. Everyone had to work. Nobody was dwelling on the fact that there was a wunderkind in the household. My brother was definitely not bowing down before my achievements. He was more interested in kicking my ass. My parents had no money, but they managed to hire violin teachers and send me to Europe to dance competitions. None of those activities put food on the table or paid for themselves. I felt the need to pitch in, too. I carried a burden of responsibility through the world, not as heavy duty as my brother's burden, but there all the same. I had to achieve. I had to do it for Max, had to do it for moms and pops, had to do it for my friends, too. During those high school years, my mom drove me everywhere. Moms are crazy. Moms are amazing. She wasn't out there boasting about me and wasn't often on the sidelines. Instead, she was in the car waiting for her son to finish this or that lesson. For the past year, I had been attending the Hudson School in Hoboken, New Jersey, which I traveled to via the commuter train that ran through Saddlebrook. My mom was the person who picked me up in Hoboken after school to drive me to a youth orchestra rehearsal on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Then we'd sit in traffic, heading back through the city in order for me to rehearse ballroom dance from 9 to 11 at night because my dance partners all lived way out in Brooklyn. During all the shuttling back and forth, she would always have sandwiches. Yulia, my mom, everyone was always making me sandwiches. On the way back home, I would eat and we would talk. I'd play hip-hop music and my mom hated it, saying, "This is garbage," but still letting me play it. I'd be blasting Juicy by Notorious B.I.G. as my personal anthem while my mom winced behind the wheel. We drove nearly every day from Jersey to Manhattan to Brooklyn to Jersey. And meanwhile, I'd be worrying to myself, "Holy fuck, how am I going to do my homework for tomorrow?" Then answering myself, "Oh, okay, I'll do it on the train in the morning." That was it. That was our routine. For years, there was so much time, so much love, and so much sandwich making invested in me. That first Junior Worlds Championship, where Diana and I came in 13th place, was held in April 2000. The following year's juniors were scheduled for Turin, Italy, in October 2001. So it was a year and a half between those two competitions, and after that year and a half, I was a completely different dancer. I had turned 15 by then, and the difference between a young 14 and an older 15 was a difference of cigarettes, girls, and a little bit more teenage swagger. Two crucial competitions led up to the 2001 Junior Worlds in November, the German Open and the U.S. Open. That August, I entered the German Open with Dina. It was a competition that had always been good to me. My first appearance on the international stage had been there with another partner 3 years before. This time around, I was third. Because of age limitations, Nino Langella did not compete at the German Open that year, which robbed the event of some magic. Alex Zampriello came in ahead of me, an amazing dancer, but a by-the-book systems guy. He danced with his sister as his partner. Where's the chemistry in that? What can that arrangement be but synchronized movement? When you're dancing with your sister, how much fire can that rumba really have? A week after the German Open, still at the end of summer 2001, I met Alex again in the U.S. Open in Miami. As I mentioned, in Latin dancing, the order of the five dances is cha-cha, samba, rumba, paso doble, and jive. I had a rule of thumb for winning. It wasn't how you start out in the cha-cha, it was how you finish off in the jive. Jive was my shit. I owned it. One of the reasons I excelled was probably that I played basketball my whole life, almost every day since I had come to America. In Brooklyn, basketball represented a way to make friends when I didn't speak the language. The basketball moves carried over to dance. Jumping, twisting, using my legs, it all filtered into the jive, where my athleticism combined with my love for rhythm and movement killed it. In jive, only the strong survived. The dance wasn't only a certain style of energy, the jive had nuance, not just the rock and roll aspect, but the jazz rhythms that were deeply embedded within it. The jive energy came into the world over the last 100 years and it burst into competitive dance only in the past few decades. As a ballroom dance form, jive was influenced by East Coast swing, West Coast swing, the Lindy, the twist, rock and roll. It was an all-American creation. I made my name with that dance. In the U.S. Open that year, I again came in third. I couldn't believe it. By the end of August 2001, leading up to October's Junior World Championships, I was hungry, starving for a win. For the first time in my life, I consciously gave myself an ultimatum. I gotta get this. I had been dancing since I was a kid, and I was willing to do whatever it took. My dad and I always spoke about the opportunity for me to be the first American dancer ever to win 4 world titles, a championship in each age category, juniors, youth, amateur, and pro, sort of the grand slam of ballroom dancing. But if I didn't win the juniors in 2001, I wouldn't get another chance at a grand slam, because by the next year, I would age out of the junior category and be bumped up to the youth class. Beyond the grand slam, I just wanted to be the first American to win the juniors, period. That would put me in the record books, and I wanted to live forever. I wanted to come back to my home country and be like, yo, I just won worlds. I'm the best in the world. I'm a world champion. But a dark element in our lives belittles every single effort that we make toward what we love. In a minor key counterpoint to crowing over successes, don't we all hear the chorus of discouragement from our interior nag? I know I did. What are you doing? Man, you're not even that good. That negative voice has met me at every single stage of my life, and thank God for the fact that every time I've encountered it, I've been able to dismiss it. As I've said before, pride worked to save me. Pride killed the cat, or no, really, curiosity killed the cat. But pride was there as a co-conspirator. Pride can be a force for delusional behavior. Being too proud to fail can suddenly turn into being too proud to try at all. But that wasn't the case with me. Not only did pride fail to kill off my ambitions, it made my ambitions. It made my work ethic, made me want to work hard enough to win, harder than I'd ever worked for anything before. It was the same pride pushing me forward as a recently arrived immigrant who wanted to be the first American to ever win a title at Junior Worlds. Valentin Alexandrovich Chmerkovsky from Brooklyn, motherfucking New York. A world champion. Competition Part 2. What happened next, just a month before the 2001 Junior Worlds, was obviously not about dance at all. At the time, my brother was 21, and Brooklyn College had just started a dance program. He was way overqualified, but he represented a huge get for the school. So they gave him a free ride as long as he would participate in dance classes. I was still going to the Hudson School, and Max and I usually took the train together in the morning. I would hit the streets in Hoboken, and he would continue to Manhattan on a PATH train, switching to the subway at the World Trade Center station to carry on to Brooklyn College. There was a Century 21 store across the street from the World Trade, and on that Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, my brother, always the garment enthusiast, had a momentary thought that he might go over and check out some fashion. Max decided against it, got on the subway, and headed over to Brooklyn. As soon as the train emerged from the tunnel beneath the East River, every cell phone in the car started going off. Behind him in Lower Manhattan, the World Trade Center was on fire, and the world as we knew it had ended. My school was located across the Hudson River from downtown Manhattan, and we witnessed the tragedy in real time as it was happening. The Twin Towers were right there, only a couple of miles away. Of course, the situation was pure mayhem, and the school administrator sent all the students home. My parents were frantic, but thankfully Max was okay. I was okay. Everyone in the Core 4 was safe. In the aftermath, the whole New York City area was paralyzed with grief and uncertainty. What do we do? Do we go to school and work the next day? Everything normal had crashed to the ground, with those towers, the attack on the Pentagon, and the nosedive of Flight 93 into a field in Pennsylvania. A lot of Russian immigrant families were in computer programming, and many of them worked in the World Trade Center. My father's first computer programming job had been in the towers. The Twin Towers represented New York City for me, and as far as I was concerned, they made up the skyline of the world. Like a lot of people, after 9/11 happened, I went a little numb. I concentrated on putting one foot in front of the other. Ballroom dancing had been placed in a harsh perspective, fading into insignificance. Yet on the other hand, it was all that I had to hold on to. On September 12th, Rising Stars reopened, basically because we didn't know what else to do. I called my partner, Dina. Are we practicing today? The Junior Worlds were a month away, coming up in October. We would be returning to the competition where we had placed 13th the year before. As I said, I had changed since then, and definitely the world had changed utterly when the towers fell. It's an odd reality, but as trivial as dancing appeared to be in the wake of an enormous tragedy, somehow I became all the more intense in my devotion to it. Dance seemed to me to be some sort of fortress that I could erect against all the evil, all the violence, all the hatred in the world. I began to train with a vengeance, channeling my anger, fear, and hurt into making my muscles scream for relief. A combination of factors figured in, not only the events of 9/11, but my responsibilities to my parents and brother, my third place finishes in recent competitions, and my unyielding determination as an immigrant to do my country proud. Most mornings before school, my father would take me to a track at a nearby Boys and Girls Club. I'd put on my headphones and listen to Nas's It Was Written, running laps until I dropped. I would swim twice a week too, run the other days, and I came to love the burn. No one else in ballroom dance was doing anything like that, especially in the United States. Dancers weren't generally into body conditioning. They treated ballroom as a hobby, while I had begun treating it as an athletic enterprise, as well as a lifeline in times of despair. Working out saved me. There was no accepted exercise regimen for ballroom dancing back then, and I had no one to look to for a blueprint. The more it hurt, the more I loved it, because the more I knew I was growing. If you cheat on your road work in the dark of the morning, said the boxer Joe Louis, you will be found out in the big fight under the bright lights. I had tunnel vision, focusing on the belief that hard work would always pay off. In the middle of October 2001, we headed off to Italy for the Junior Worlds once again. My father, my partner Diana, her mom Elena, and dad Volodya. This time around, we didn't lose our luggage. This time, we weren't rookie outsiders. This time, we were ready. On the day of the competition, I stood with Dina on the sidelines, preparing ourselves mentally for what was to come, listening as the opening announcement came over the loudspeaker. The Junior World Championship is a celebration of international community through ballroom dancing, said the announcer over the loudspeaker. This year, we even have representation from the United States of America. The night before the contest started, my dad and I had taken a walk around Turin together. It was late, but Italy keeps a late schedule, and there were still people in the restaurants. The tradition before competition was usually very strict. You go to bed early, and you wake up early. There's a whole schedule that I would normally adhere to, but my father was clearly in a thoughtful mood, so we strolled in the darkness along the River Po. We didn't speak much, just quietly enjoyed each other's company. I've always raved about what a great father he is, how supportive and motivating he'd been to me. But in truth, he was still awkward as fuck around his sons. We never had the sex conversation, for example. We never had a heart-to-heart about weakness, say, or nerves, or courage. My dad always kept it simple. You physically ready? You good? You need anything? Our walk that night was not about talking so much as taking in the environment. The weather was warm and perfect. In Italy, the air always smelled like history to me. We both realized the magnitude of the occasion, how close we were to our dreams. There were no fancy speeches. For my father, action always meant more than words. But I'll take to my grave that near silent walk along a river in Italy. It was a moment suspended in time. "Go to bed now," my father said to me as we returned to the hotel. "You need to get some sleep." I woke up ready the next morning. As a pre-game ritual, my father always helped put the competition number to the back of my costume. The numbered placard was made out of paper, and when you sweat, it could become a little ragged. You attached it to your costume with 4 safety pins, but not all competitions provided the pins, so Dad always brought his own. He also had clear scotch tape that he would wrap around the number to make it solid, so no amount of flop sweat would matter. My dad was a man of consistency and a certain devotion to regimen and patterns. We never compromised. If we had pinned the number on and wrapped it in the tape before, we would do that again for every competition. It wasn't about superstition, really, so much as being in the moment and remembering the details each time I stepped out onto that floor. As a father and son duo, we weren't perfect, but the bond between us was unbreakable, because an immense sense of gratitude laid behind all these small, seemingly insignificant actions. The pinning on the competition number was a pure gesture of fatherly love. That morning, I danced in competition with a little American flag sewn onto my shirt. It really wasn't something that you do in ballroom dancing. Not at all. There was a high risk of offending the traditions and conventions of the dance world. I also had a tracksuit with an American flag on the front and USA emblazoned on the back in large letters. You could say it was too much, that it was jingoistic, but you have to bring yourself back to the period I'm talking about. Many Americans were driving around with the stars and stripes on their car antennas. As a display of patriotism, it wasn't much, but as a country, we were desperate for solidarity. This wasn't to say I walked around after 9/11 pounding my chest, shouting, "America! America!" Yes, there was a huge sense of pride in my country, but that pride was there before the World Trade Center was attacked and will be there forever afterwards, too. The tracksuit always helped me feel like an athlete, psyching myself up for a big game. When I walked onto the competition floor and warmed up, wearing the flag provided an extra sense of drive. Dina and I already stood out, because at juniors that year, we were the only U.S. couple in competition. In that sea of tracksuits, we were the 2 American flags floating free. "We have a really incredible opportunity here," I told her. "Let's take advantage of it. We have a chance to do something great. Let's do it, okay?" In hindsight, I have to second-guess myself a little. You little 15-year-old shit. Who do you think you are, Russell Crowe in Gladiator? Actually, that's exactly who I thought I was. We went into competition and started killing it. The dance felt good, and the good vibes only increased as Dina and I survived cut after cut. By the time we got into the quarterfinals, the top 24 couples, the event had gone into an evening session that started after the same formal parade from the previous year's competition. I'm not gonna lie, my dad and my partner's dad might have had a drink or two that evening. As Dina and I walked in the parade, the production values were a little higher, the spotlights were a little brighter, and the audience was now a little louder. I was feeling it, but I was also feeling the flag I was wearing, too. "Yo," my cocky 15-year-old Brooklyn self said to my partner, "we have 15 more dances. Let's do this." I could not wait for the music to start. Dina and I killed it in the quarterfinals and went through into the semis. Now we had 5 dances in a row. Ordinary contestants get to take a break, catch their breath, or talk some strategy. A coach or parent might come over to say, "Hey, you really aced that cha-cha." My father would never do that, but I would look over at him and he would always throw me a thumbs up. When I got that thumbs up, I became bulletproof. I turned into a superhero. The semifinals came down to the top 12 couples, and we were all out on the floor at once, so there was a direct comparison of dancers right next to each other. We started out the semis with the cha-cha, and we were both on a roll. We were cruising. We have a chance to do something great. It was just a tiny bit of grandiosity from a young kid, but it had the effect of putting Dina and me on the same page. Ballroom dance judging was always subjective and open to political influence, and contestants didn't make the step from the semis to the finals for a lot of different reasons. Shit happened. I didn't know what kind of political game existed among the judges, but I did know there were 2 Italian couples who were definitely in the top rank, as well as 2 Russian couples. I felt as though Dina and I should definitely be up there too, but I really didn't know how it would fall out. But we did end up making the finals, so I was riding on an enormous wave of energy. By this time, both our fathers were feeling extra loose and courageous. And in an arena full of Italians, these 2 drunk Russian-American fathers made more noise than anyone, waving an American flag in pride and intoxication, hand in hand with the symbol of freedom. The MC introduced the remaining 6 couples. I experienced mad fears. I had these 2 inebriated dudes shouting, "USA! USA!" And I was afraid we might get disqualified simply because of the antics of our supporters. We performed our bows, and right afterward they made an announcement in Italian. "One last time, please give it up for your finalists and their last dance, the jive." Poet that I was, I heard the announcement's rhythmic energy build and could anticipate the music starting. I began doing the moonwalk in silence right in front of the judges, arriving perfectly in time at the perfect spot. It was so fly and it felt good. Even so, I was terrified, thinking my American showboating might offend the international judges. No one in the audience could help themselves. Every eye in the place turned to us. On the floor stood Alex and his partner, and they had claimed their space, but I passed right in front of them. It was as if they weren't there. Once I managed to claim the crowd, no other couple in the arena had an audience. The air sort of went out of everything that everyone else was doing, which was a pretty disheartening development for them. It wasn't just the judges who noticed the shift in attention, but everyone in the hall. I performed my little moonwalk introduction, and right as Little Richard slammed into the title words to the song Tutti Frutti, I jumped into a half split like James Brown, bounced back upright, and started the routine. It was incredible. The moonwalk and the James Brown split had nothing much to do with ballroom dancing at all. They are both just subliminal influences for me, because I wasn't even that much of a Michael Jackson fan as a kid. But that little move, that small, riffy variation, that divergence from the norm, with a melting pot of pop music elements poured into the dance, that was the American in me, and that's what made the routine unique and special. We finished the finals. It felt incredible, all right, but who knew what the outcome would be? Judges were fickle, adjudicators, they are called within the dance world, and they had the power to adjudicate me right out of my socks. Dances have felt incredible to me before, and the results never seemed to match my enthusiasm. We did our final bows, and one of the traditions was to link arms with all the finalists and run across the floor together. It was a tradition that the pros started, and I had seen them, exhausted after the finals, linking arms and doing their run together. My whole life, I had wanted to make that run, but you could only do it if you were in the finals at a major competition. As we all joined together and dashed across the floor, I flashed back to all those mornings running laps at the Boys and Girls Club in New Jersey. The moment was awesome. It was cool, but But then we had to await the results. The announcers called out the sixth place couple, fifth place, fourth place, third place, and Dina and I had wound up in the top two. We were either going to win or be the runners-up. I stood back. As I've said, I'm not much of a religious person at all. I was raised with plenty of tradition and culture, with Eastern European and Jewish influences, but I didn't have that intimate of a link with organized religion. I had my relationship with God through dance. I had such a great appreciation for the spirit of the universe, a connection that flows directly from my heart. I felt it strongly at that moment. Fingers crossed, I was praying for a win. Then a spill of Italian words echoed in the hall, and the announcers named Dina and me winners of the 2001 Junior World Latin Dance Championship. What happened next was pure chaos. The word celebration took on a whole new definition. My dad ran over, grabbed the American flag, and raced up and down the floor, leading the chant of USA, USA. As shocked as everyone was initially, soon afterward, the entire arena in this little town in Italy began chanting the three-letter abbreviation of my home country. They played the victory chords as Dina and I took a bow. Then I bent down and I kissed the floor. My 15-year-old self was way extra on everything. I had watched too much Michael Jordan, too many athletes winning it all, and seen what they did. I sought to emulate them. When we received our medals and stood on the podium, it turned out that they couldn't raise the American flag, because my dad still had it. He had to walk across the floor, and I had to step forward to take the flag from him. It felt like some sort of ritualized, formal handover. All I needed at that moment was a bald eagle on my shoulder. Then they played the anthem. I didn't see a dry eye in the house, but I couldn't be sure because my own eyes were full of tears. At that time, I probably couldn't have put the feeling into words, but in my heart, I was thoroughly and completely convinced that hard work and sacrifice always paid off. You will never be able to tell me otherwise. Happiness is relative. Moments aren't bought. They're earned. They're felt in the present, but are created by the past. Ultimately, at the heart of every moment is the effort you've put into making it real. Your effort determines how much the moment matters to you and to the people around you, the ones you love who share the experience with you. I looked to my left, and there was a couple that Dina and I had never beaten until now. I was in a country where I'd never taken first place before, in a competition that no American had ever won before, and I stood with a flag that I felt had never been raised so high before. To me, this was the beautiful realization of the American dream. Dance with me. In the opening years of the new millennium, if you cast your eye across the dance landscape in America, a few realities would become immediately apparent. While dance in general was hugely popular, ballroom dancing was far from the most fashionable form, rarely appearing in the curriculum of schools, colleges, and academies. Instead, classes in jazz, ballet, and tap were much more common, lately joined by hip-hop. These were the dance styles that were ingrained in the culture, especially amongst kids in this country. Ballroom dancing was something our grandparents did, old and outmoded, an outlier in the field. Nobody under 30 knew who Lawrence Welk was, even though he had hosted a ballroom dance show that was among the longest-running programs in television history. Even when considering the smaller slice of the larger dance demographic, what Rising Stars did, teaching ballroom dancing to children, was a negligible, almost non-existent sector of the market. The ballroom dance scene at the time was dominated by something called social dance, which was where maybe 90% of the ballroom action went down in America. Social dance lessons taught ballroom dancing to adults, and were a whole different animal compared to what we offered at Rising Stars. Two social dance franchise chains, operating under the names of famous dancers Fred Astaire and Arthur Murray, had studios all over the United States. They were the giants within the still limited field of ballroom dance. The atmosphere in these kinds of studios was very social, very laid back, very much a case of go at your own pace. Only a small amount of instruction focused on preparing clients for dance contests, because in the eyes of the schools, they were just that, only clients. It was almost always older adults who were doing the competing. Whenever they did bother to concern themselves with competition, the big social dance studios concentrated on events that were labeled Pro-Am, for professional amateur, because students would enter with their teachers. If studios in the Fred Astaire or Arthur Murray chains offered instruction to kids, the classes were usually tossed in as an afterthought, typically scheduled at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning or something, which for most working parents might as well have been before the crack of dawn. At Rising Stars, we might have appreciated the big chain studios teaching social dance as huge businesses that dwarfed ours, but we knew we rode in an entirely different lane and had an entirely different approach. We were hardcore ballroom dancers with a laser-like focus on helping kids to succeed in the cutthroat world of competition. There weren't many other people who were doing what we did, and within that small sector of the market, Rising Stars had soared to the top of the heap. As every school teacher understood all too well, there were problems and challenges associated with teaching kids. While social dance studios catered to adult egos and petted and pampered their clientele, kids needed more structure and authority. Rising Stars should have posted a sign in the entrance, "Check your ego at the door." Instead, we had my dad, who served as the authority up front, who kept everybody's ego in check. Trust me, that was not easy to do, especially with the parents of the students. One of my father's favorite phrases summed up the situation. 99% of successful kids is due to the parents, and 99% of failure is also due to the parents. A woman from Long Island named Jana Volanets had enrolled her two children, Nicole and Teddy, in a Brooklyn ballroom dance school. Jana was a powerhouse. Emigrating from Ukraine in that first wave of refugees during the 1970s, she had risen in the ranks of Wall Street as a stockbroker, making her first fortune within a decade after arriving in America. Then she switched over to real estate investment and made a second fortune doing that. She was smart as a whip, beautiful and confident, and she wanted to give her children a taste of the ballroom world that she had experienced growing up in Ukraine. After a year and a half taking lessons in Brooklyn, Nicole Volanets accompanied Jana to a competition held in New York Marriott Marquis in Times Square, the Empire Dance Championship. There, something beautiful happened that changed the energetic mother's mind about the approach she was taking in teaching her kids ballroom dancing. She happened to catch a dance performed by Max Schmirkovsky. With his partner Elena, Max competed in the Latin event. I remember the evening well. After he performed a paso doble, my brother walked off the floor. I was barely 16 years old and thought I had to function like a corner man in boxing. I rushed up to give Max water, quick-like so he could take a sip and replenish himself mid-competition. The moment really did resemble a pause in a boxing match, lacking only the ring girls parading around with placards announcing the round. I threw some water on the floor for Max to wet the bottom of his shoes, a typical ballroom hack that helped give friction to the soles so they didn't slip and slide on the parquet. "All right, go out and kill that jive," I whispered, knowing that the final dance in the series was most important. To repeat my rule of thumb, it wasn't how you start out in the cha-cha, it was how you finish in the jive. Then I wished him luck, told him how great he was doing, kissed his cheek, and sent him off. And Max did kill the jive that night, mesmerizing the judges, the audience, and the other dancers. He also floored one onlooker in particular, Jana, who watched transfixed and totally charmed as my brother danced. Jana was too stunned to approach her new ballroom crush right there and then, but she made sure to check the program and try to figure out how she could get in touch with him. "Where's this kid's studio?" she asked everyone around her. "Because I am going." She found that Max worked out of Rising Stars Dance Academy And in the days following the championships, she called to sign her daughter Nicole up for a private lesson. Driving her children to New Jersey from Long Island, Jana arrived at the smelly, nothing fancy studio, its walls cluttered with graffiti, competition numbers, and ballroom dance trophies won by our school students and instructors. The story is family lore, and I still have a mental image of that day. Jana wore a mink coat and perhaps $200,000 worth of jewelry on her person, and looked as out of place as a royal duchess in a boxing gym. She came off as possibly the most bougie woman in the world, definitely the most bougie person who ever walked through the door at Rising Stars. What resulted was the creation of the oddest of odd couples. Not Jana and Max, but Jana and another just as unique member of the Chmerkovsky family. On that first visit, Jana was immediately met by the manager and all-around boss of the academy, my dad. Miss Wall Street, meet the beast from the east. You have to understand that my father did not exactly exhibit the most inviting energy. Even when in a good mood, he looked as if he were pissed at something. Charmingly pissed. Beautifully pissed. But nonetheless, still fairly intimidating. He had the syndrome, commonly identified nowadays as resting bitch face, and carried it off pretty well and quite consistently. Underneath it all, my pops was a real teddy bear. He was just results-oriented, not comfort-oriented. Sure. He received newcomers politely, but he lacked the fawning nature of a restaurant maitre d'. At Rising Stars, we were not at your service. This was an academy that had trained some of the best athletes in the world. If you chose to be a part of it, you were very welcome. Come in, sign the paperwork, hit the floor, and start working. Jana told me later that the vibe was, "This is an intense place." Tacked to the wall behind my dad's front counter was a handmade poster with this motto spelled out in large letters. Fail to prepare, prepare to fail. There was minimal nonsense and very little lip service paid to conventional niceties. Nobody was there to small talk you into liking us. We were going to show you results, and that was why you were going to love us. Not pretend to like us, but really and truly appreciate what Rising Stars had going on. We didn't exist to raise the esteem of parents, but to realize the potential of their kids. I have my daughter, Nicole. She has a private lesson with Maxim Chmerkovsky, Jana said when she met my dad, stuttering a little but pronouncing the last name flawlessly. So a lesson with Max, he said. You just wait in the seating area and he'll be right with you. Okay, Jana said, looking around a little helplessly. Where can I put my coat? My dad shrugged. Put it in the same closet with everybody else's jacket, he said simply and wandered away. Honey, hold on to the mink if it's so precious to you, was the not quite subliminal message. Instead of being put off, Jana was actually impressed. Okay, she thought, now this is refreshing. I think our studio might have reminded her of the old world dance academies that she hadn't seen in 20 plus years. It didn't matter where you were from or how much money you had. At Rising Stars, there were no separations based on class, race, or social status. We couldn't care less about where you came from or who you were. We based our judgments on how you acted and how you treated others. We were not going to be flexible with the individual, but rather the individual had to be flexible within the Rising Stars system, which was all about family, camaraderie, and equality. As usual, I was working out on the parquet myself, and I sort of idly surveilled Jana as she sat in the waiting area with her mink coat wrapped around her. Rich bitch was the two-word rhyme that passed through my mind. She watched Nicole have her first lesson with Max. Max the charmer. Max the charismatic. Max the larger-than-life personality that they both had first encountered the previous weekend, winning the Empire Championship. But he was a very different Max. Max the drill sergeant. No coddling went on out on the floor. No empty compliments either. No very good, very good, oh, very good. But instead, not enough. That's not enough. That's not enough. If you wanted compliments, you earned them at the competitions, where they were cold medals. So the lesson ended with, now go home and fucking practice this, you little shit. Well, not those precise words, of course, but that was the sentiment that came through loud and clear from my darling, cut the crap brother. I thought that might be it for Jana, that she would head out the door and never return after witnessing Max at work. Once again, though, Jana was less offended than startled and impressed. The studio still struck her as pretty stinky, but somehow the stench now indicated hard work and perseverance, like discipline was in the air. She fell in love with the whole package. After the hour and a half lesson, she collected her daughter and approached my father in the front office. That was great, she said. How much do I owe you? $80, he said. Well, here's 80, she said, counting out the bills. And here's 100 for the kid. I stood there as a silent witness. Uh-oh, I thought. Here comes a stern correction from my dad. He stared at the woman, then glanced down at the bill in her hand. What? What's that for? Oh, you know, for the kid, Jana repeated, referring to my brother. She wanted to tip my brother. As though it were radioactive, my dad carefully took the 100, smoothed it out, and gave it back. We don't tip here, he told her more gently than I had expected. This isn't one of those places. I saw a moment pass between them, two very different but like-minded people crossing each other's paths at completely different times in their lives. Okay, Jana said, tucking the bill back into her Givenchy. My dad wasn't being rude, and neither was Jana. This was a woman who had an old-world upbringing, who had raised her kids in a new-world atmosphere, but who was now linking back up with an old-school environment at Rising Stars. The style of the place was familiar to her, but unfamiliar to her children, and she loved Max's tough love attitude. Being denied the acceptance of that tip made her understand that our school was not driven by money, but by passion and people. That first visit thoroughly seduced Jana Volonets. She enrolled both Nicole and Teddy at Rising Stars and began driving from her home on Long Island 3, 4, and finally 5 or 6 times a week. She would occasionally rent out a room at a nearby hotel on Friday nights so she and her kids wouldn't have to commute back to Jersey for a Saturday morning lesson. During this time, it wasn't just Max teaching. I was there, too. I witnessed the lessons unfold and watched as Nicole and Teddy grew better each week. Now it was our turn to be impressed. Wow. Here was a lady putting in 2 hours each way in traffic for her kids to be able to take lessons with us. We examined that fact and thought to ourselves that it didn't really matter who she was. Whether she had $5 or $5,000 in her pocket, she was going to get our very best. Nicole and Teddy would receive our undivided attention, focus, and effort because Jana reminded me and Max of what our mom used to do for us. Here was a model parent, I thought, the kind who was willing to go the extra mile, literally, in New York traffic for her kids. In my dad's formula of attributing 99% of success or failures to the parents, Jana was the kind who helped ensure her children's success. Both Nicole and Teddy thrived at Rising Stars. We started building a relationship, a friendship between our family and hers. Soon, Jana no longer had to book a room at the local Marriott because she stayed with us in our crummy second-floor apartment. She loved my mother and the warm style of the household. Slowly, as others had done before, she fell in love with our world, with its twin draws of my mom's cooking and my dad's lectures. Her interest expanded to embrace not just her kids, but to our business itself, because she was an expert businesswoman who sensed an opportunity. I've seen it all, you know, she told us. I've traveled the world. I've done it all. I've put Nicole and Ted into a million activities, from karate, sports, gymnastics, to art, to everything. And only Rising Star is stuck. And why did this stick? What is it that you have here that's so magical? And how can you expand it? We had never before really looked at our business from a business standpoint. We considered Rising Star as more of an institution, a place that probably should have received government arts funding if only we could figure out how to apply for some. As my parents built a friendship with Jana, my father began to open up to her a little more after each family dinner we shared, a little closer after each round of vodka. It was as if she was peeling away at my dad's thick, gruff layers in the course of a series of dinner conversations. At first, he dismissed out of hand the ideas that she would throw his way, but then he slowly began warming to them. Soon enough, I noticed the pronouns had shifted in Jana's conversations, switching from you to we. As I said, my family was a we kind of environment. Together, my parents and Jana developed Dance With Me, a social dance studio aimed at adults. With Max as lead instructor and me with my national and international competition trophies, Dance With Me was an immediate success. We opened more branches, still trying to retain the warm community feeling that was featured at Rising Stars. In all our enterprises, we insisted on keeping that family environment. The heart was going to always be there, we told ourselves. We were never going to sell out. The emphasis would always be on people, never on how beautiful our decor was, or how fancy our chandeliers were, or how clean-cut, suited up, and fresh our staff was going to be, even though all those would be true in our case. My father's pride, Jana's ability to create a high-end product with superior execution and beautiful attention to details, and their shared work ethic and the camaraderie between them formed the foundation of what Dance With Me ultimately became. Jana didn't stop there. Why don't we start a nonprofit organization to support dance instruction? She asked. We could call it Dance Team USA. She suggested ways such a move could benefit the world of ballroom. I have some rich friends, basically, Jana told us. What a nonprofit organization can do is receive donations that the donors could then write off. In return, you'd have a way to provide scholarships and sponsor competitions. Dance lessons are expensive. There are a lot of kids out there who can't afford what Nicole and Ted's family can. Like a one-woman rocket ship fueled by enthusiastic energy and the spirit of philanthropy, Jana swept everything along her wake. Rising Stars Dance Academy was already the leading school in the nation for instructing children in the art of ballroom dancing. Now, with Dance Team USA and the Dance With Me Studios, the Chmerkovsky family began to widen its sphere of influence, becoming players in the dance world as a whole. In the sometimes incestuous, claustrophobic world of ballroom, quite a bit of animosity arose over the alliance between my father and Jana, because outsiders rarely grasped that we were connecting on a level that had nothing to do with money or status, but instead had everything to do with passion and purpose. Together, Jana and my dad embarked on different projects. He loved that we were expanding and enjoyed working with a savvy business partner. The mood was not always babies and butterflies, because as with any enterprise involving strong personalities, there was some tension. These were two very passionate, stubborn people, and they bumped heads a lot of the time. But out of that friction came magic. My father believed that there was nothing wrong with confrontation, or with a couple of fiery people going at it, hammer and tongs. As long as there was a common goal, he felt, there would be a great end result. Operating as Dance Team USA, we founded new competitions at the junior and youth age levels, the Grand Danceport Cup. We discovered a gorgeous classic venue, the Grand Prospect Hall, on Prospect Avenue in Park Slope in Brooklyn, which reminded all of us, Jana included, of an Eastern European ballroom auditorium. I loved the large Victorian-era building, which featured an exterior in the French Renaissance style, a soaring entrance lobby with an ornate gilded ceiling, twin marble staircases, and plenty of room inside for a dance competition. It was perfect. The event could be an escape for young kids to play dress-up and be little kings and queens for the day. Why not put them in a place where they could really feel like royalty? We had the space and we had the event. And finally, we could link together a circuit for junior-level competition that would help reshape the dance landscape in the whole country. Young ballroom students now had a series of events and a point system similar to professional-level competition. They say as one door closes, another opens. But the opposite is also true. By opening the multiple doors of Dance Team USA, Dance With Me, and the Grand Danceport Cup, Jana and my father helped broaden a world formerly limited to Rising Stars Dance Academy. But just down the line, another door would slam shut from 2,000 miles away, robbing us of our very own Rising Star, the hardest working stallion in the family stable, a figure that everyone else in the core gang of four revolved around. Out of that development, in turn, came success on a whole other level, breaking our world open as though it were a piñata, showering us all with candy. In Hollywood during that same period, without any of us knowing anything about it, a reality TV show was taking shape with an odd format that paired celebrities with professional ballroom dancers. Lust. Before I started competing on Dancing with the Stars, I'd only had 7 partners over my entire competitive dance career. Deep, serious, long-lasting relationships that, for me, formed the most important bonds outside those with my family. The decision to leave a partner was always an agonizing one, and likewise, the decision to take on a new partner was huge. By comparison, Dancing with the Stars had created a totally different environment, a somewhat unreal, artificial situation whereby I had had to take on a different partner every season. But whether stretching over years in reality or compressed into a short 3 months on reality TV, competing as a ballroom dance couple represented a total immersion in another person's being. I got to know everything about my partner, her laughter, her tears, what motivated her, what left her cold. Over the course of the rehearsal period, I would discover how she looked, felt, sounded, smelled, all the senses except taste, I guess. But some of these women could have activated the taste buds pretty well, too. It has seemed to me that the obvious comparison was marriage, and some of the same dynamics applied. If my partner and I were growing as a dance couple, then the relationship was healthy. But if we were stale creatively, I'd know we were in trouble. Since I have never been married, the comparison could be false in any number of ways. I wouldn't know. But I understand that the intense heightened feeling of dance is similar to lovemaking, involving supercharged episodes of sensual communication between a man and woman. Or for me, in my younger days, between a boy and a girl. I took dance lessons and entered competitions long before I ever had sex. It was an odd situation, because in one way or another, ballroom is all about sex, or to put it in a more academic way, ballroom is a highly stylized performance activity based on the exchanges and postures involved in human sexuality. So when I started taking lessons at age 4, I lacked a fundamental understanding of what I was doing. It was like learning to drive a car on a closed race course without knowing anything about steering a vehicle in traffic. I felt like a very lucky man when I reached adulthood, because ballroom helped me learn how to approach a woman, how to relate with sensitivity to another human being, how to embrace the lessons of chivalry and empathy. From a very young age, I was in close physical proximity with the opposite sex. We had to touch, hold hands, embrace, and do it all without losing our shit. The social awkwardness that other kids went through totally disappeared under constant, almost daily contact. Relating to a girl on a one-on-one basis simply became a natural part of my young life. In contrast, during youth sports, say, players weren't normally exposed to the opposite sex at all, definitely not in the locker room. Being on an all-boys team tended to reinforce preconceptions about girls, rather than work to dismantle childish prejudices. Because I started learning ballroom at such a young age, sex was in my life for a long time before I even knew what it was. An 800-pound gorilla I lived with, even though we had never been formally introduced. Later on, when I showed up in Brooklyn, I was plunged into a culture that was very different from my Eastern European background, and it took me a while to get my bearings. In America, the reality of the street was hot and wild and loose in ways it could never be in the Jessa. I witnessed violence in the hood, yes, but I also encountered a sexually charged atmosphere that was intoxicating, mystifying, and frightening all at the same time. Even with all that, I didn't get into self-pleasuring until I was like 11 or 12. I mean, I didn't have my first real girlfriend until a couple of years later when puberty hit me like a truck. I was 14, but with braces, I looked like a solid 12. She was 16 and hung out with 18 or 19-year-old dudes who smoked cigarettes and drove cars. Of course she was a dancer. I have always loved dancers, not only because they share the social circle that I move in, but because dancers are just naturally tuned into the world of sensuality and romance. At least I thought. She danced in an older, under 21 category, so at first I encountered her only from afar, as a spectator. I don't think I'd ever have really looked at girls like that before in my life. But when I gazed at her dancing with a partner, displaying all the elaborate moves of ballroom, I felt a sick urgency to be near her, to spend time with her, to hear her speak. Watching her dance was a revelation. It was as if after all those years I suddenly understood what ballroom was all about. Lila. Beautiful Lila. She was a Brooklyn girl, which meant you could add 10 years to her chronological age in order to understand her level of sophistication and cool. She came out of the Russian immigrant community, and that helped us to connect over our common background. But because I was living in Jersey with my parents and had no access to a car, we were simply separated geographically. What was love? I had no idea back then, but even as a kid, I'd always have an appetite for one. A questing, restless, hungry attitude toward the world, lusting for more experience, more sensations, more, more. Whether it was turning ambition into art or approaching competition either on the dance floor or on the basketball court, the same instinct sustained me. Right from the start, the hunger followed me into my love life and my interest in women. What did I want from Lila? More. Grown up, fully developed sexual attraction was something I was feeling in my body for the first time. This wasn't the puppy love I'd felt for Vanessa back in grade school. I had never before experienced the type of desire so overwhelming. At the same time, I was definitely punching above my weight class, and there was no way in hell that I had a chance with this girl. Though I had started to man up a little bit, I still had braces, like I said, and how was I going to kiss with a mouth full of prickly metal? Lila didn't dance at our studio, but was at a Brooklyn dance academy where my best friend Alex and Igor took lessons. But within our little world of ballroom, I was the alpha kid in my age group, so of course she knew who I was. She saw me. We went to some of the same competitions, and at one, the Ohio Star Ball, I sat behind her with my two best friends, Igor and Alex. I thought she probably saw us as a trio of gnats buzzing around her head, but an amazing thing occurred. I said something funny and Lila laughed. Oh my God, I could now die happy. I think I have a shot with her, I whispered to my buds. They howled, dismissed the whole idea. Later, when Lila left her seat and walked away, I turned to them. I'll make you a bet, I said. I'm going to win her over. They thought I was out of my mind. The prospect was so beyond the realm of possibility that they only laughed at me. But it wasn't the first time I heard naysayers mock my ambitions. Later that night, after the competition, Lila and I ended up in a room together, amongst friends, and we all started playing a game of, yeah, truth or dare. Somebody dared her to make out with me. To this day, I owe that kid a solid. It was the greatest thing in the world. From that point on, and for the next half year, Lila and I were constantly in touch through AIM, Instant Messenger. For the first time in my life, I almost flunked one of my classes. My grades dipped dramatically in ninth grade because I was chasing this girl. Every night I would wait for everybody to go to sleep, log in on the computer, and instant message with her. I always worried that the electronic squeal of a dial-up internet connection, something not many people remember nowadays, might wake my parents. We would talk and I suddenly became Shakespeare. That's really where all my writing comes from, the source from which everything else flowed, writing poetry to Lila trying to win her heart.